Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on contracts when we come back. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, and when it comes to law, we seem to be among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies, the multinational corporations, the lobbies, and the news media. But we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. Now, the courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, our liberties, and our property. It's not in the Congress, and it's not in the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination, for example, is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to one who is indifferent thereto, because it is a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat, and it cannot be claimed by an attorney or solicitor for you. It is valid only when insisted upon by you, the belligerent claimant in person. So says U.S. versus Johnson. And that's why I contend that we should listen more to our judges and less to our politicians and lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said in that statement? Your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or solicitor. Your rights can only be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant in person. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining, educational, informative, and free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about contracts. Contracts come in many forms. One of the forms of contract is called adhesion contract. So last time we were looking at the subject matter of adhesion contracts. That's a contract that binds to you that you may not even know exists. A warranty contract, when you fill out that warranty card, remember? You see a card in the box with the product that you've just bought, and you fill out that card and you send it in. And in your mind, that's the warranty. The words on the card are the terms of the agreement. That's not so. The terms of the agreement are written up in the warranty and filed with the Secretary of State in Connecticut or Florida or California, or in some cases maybe in China or France or Italy. You know, when you buy a box and it contains goods that are manufactured in France and it has French and Spanish language on it, you are a part of the New World Order. You're a part and parcel of the New World Economy. You're making a contract that may be upheld or enforced in some court in some foreign country, if you want to protect your property rights, for instance. Now, from the point of view of a sovereign individual, what has happened is that there has been a breach of contract with our government. Government has now usurped the common law, that's the Ten Commandments, and replaced it with a form of the Roman civil law. That's the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. And as a result, government is constantly managing our affairs without our authority. But they certainly have our consent. Now, constructive or quasi-contracts are pure fictions of law. They are not contracts. They presume a performance of duty without regard to the assent of both parties. All right, let's pause for a moment and think about that. I was raised in an era when we didn't have seat belts. So you could buy an automobile, drive it, and then there was no seat belt in it. And if you had an accident, you might be thrown out of it. You might go through the windshield. All kinds of bad things could happen to you because you didn't wear your seat belt. And I'm sure that seat belts are probably good for you. Then one day, somebody came along and said, what we need is a seat belt law. So, who is it that wants a seatbelt law? Did you or my dad or my granddad go into our legislature and say, oh my God, we've got to have a seatbelt law because we are dumb people. We don't have very good sense. We can't put a rope in our car, tie it to our seats, and tie ourselves in. So we need the manufacturers to put these ropes in our car to tie us in to keep us from hurting ourselves. Now, honest to God, kids, do you think that your granddad or your mom and dad or somebody went down to the legislature and said, please pass us a seatbelt law because we're all ignorant and stupid people and can't do it for ourselves? Now, my dad, I'm sure that if he'd have thought about it and wanted a seatbelt in his car, he would have taken a piece of rope and tied himself in. No. There's got to be some economic, there's got to be some motivator here for such a law. Who would have such a motivation? Well, the insurance industry would have such a motivation. Now, back in the 1930s, the Chrysler Corporation pioneered a new technology called safety glass. Henry Ford said that he would never put safety glass in his cars. What was going on is that when an accident would occur, you would go through the windshield. It was plate glass. Now, you probably could survive going through the windshield, but you could not survive the cuts that you endured as you went through, and so you would lay by the side of the highway and bleed to death. Now, surely there must have been a need for a law that said, thou shalt put safety glass in thy automobiles. But nobody did that. That was in the era when we were still practicing the Ten Commandments instead of the Ten Planks. And so nobody did anything about it until a guy by the name of Chrysler came along. You know, he was running a company called Dodge, the Chrysler Corporation. You know, the people that make Dodge and Plymouth cars. And so he came up with a new technology. They put a piece of plastic between two sheets of glass and put that in their cars. And then when you hit the windshield, if you went through it, you wouldn't go through it. You'd push it out, and the glass would shatter into little pieces, and it wouldn't cut you up nearly as bad, and people didn't bleed to death. And it was so popular that the Chrysler Corporation just couldn't sell cars fast enough with this new invention called safety glass. Hey, and you guessed it. And Henry Ford put safety glass in his cars, too. Not because the government mandated it, not because the people were so damn dumb they couldn't figure out that they needed to buy cars or they needed to have safety glass, but because it was a technology in the marketplace. And people like you and I, when we had to make a choice, should we buy a Ford with plate glass or should we buy a Dodge with safety glass? And more people were buying Dodges with safety glass, and so Henry Ford said, I guess if I want to compete with this new technology and what the people in the marketplace want, I guess I better put safety glass in my cars. And gosh, the people over at General Motors, and pretty soon everybody put it in. Nobody mandated jack squat. Nobody gave you a ticket because you were driving your car without safety glass. Nobody fined General Motors or anybody else because they didn't make it. In fact, you know, there were other people that were making automobiles and didn't put safety glass in it, and they found that their sales weren't as good. Now, there's an example of technology in the marketplace at work. Now, along comes the 1950s, see? And the marketplace out there won't support seatbelts. I remember that some foreign cars came into the marketplace with seatbelts. I think the Saab or the Volvo were the first ones. They came in from overseas, you know, from Europe, and they had seatbelts in them. And we didn't take to seatbelts here in this country like we took to safety glass. Now, the insurance industry comes onto the scene, and they say, gee, we sell insurance to people, and if people have seatbelts in their cars, and if they use them, of course, we have fewer accidents. So we're selling insurance, and we won't have to pay as much out on the claims window if these people are wearing seatbelts. So it was the insurance industry that promoted the use of seatbelts. Purely economic. Has nothing to do with the health, the safety, or the welfare of the public. And if you think that Mutual of Omaha gives a rat's you-know-what for your health, safety, or welfare, hey, you belong in a mental hospital, son. They're interested in profit and gain, period. That's the business of business, profit. So they went into the legislatures and said, what we need is a seatbelt law, not aimed at the drivers, aimed at the corporations who can be regulated and controlled under Hale versus Henkel, corporate capacity. So Congress comes along just like they do today. When the lobbyists come in with campaign contributions and money, the senators and representatives will enact whatever laws the industry that's seeking the law desires. In this case, the insurance industry wants a seatbelt law, and so Congress passed it. Now, as time progresses along a little bit, the manufacturers are all putting seatbelts in people's cars. It's about as popular as AIDS at an office Christmas party, and nobody uses them. So now the insurance industry comes along and says, well, we're just real concerned about Betty and Bob, and they're not wearing their seatbelts, and they're getting hurt real bad. Now, if you believe that, you belong in a mental hospital. Again, Congress and the legislatures react to the insurance industry just like they react to the pharmaceutical industry. So when the pharmaceutical industry didn't want to get sued for putting out vaccines that killed people, they put a law into effect. In fact, they had an outgoing representative from Texas put a rider on a bill. And now, if you take a vaccine and you are injured by it or killed, you cannot sue the pharmaceutical industry. So a common law right for wrongful death or injury has been taken away from you by your government. That's an example of an adhesion contract. It's a law that applies to you with or without your consent, and it may even be with or without your knowledge. Now, when we apply that to seat belts, they came along with the next step. And they said, well, now we've got to have laws that require the drivers of the cars to buckle their seatbelts. So we put in the seatbelt law. You're not buckling your seatbelt because you're concerned about an accident or your safety. You're buckling your seatbelt because you don't want to get a ticket, which is going to cost you $85, which is what I paid the last one. That's the bottom line. And that's what this game is all about. And the automobile industry, which is a very popular product, you know, your car is a very popular product, and travel is a right. Well, it was a right from Mount Sinai until recent years when it was converted to a privilege. And so now Americans have a privilege to drive, which has been converted from a right to travel. And it's regulated and controlled for the purposes of making profit and gain for the state. And the state, every time they can catch you driving your car without your seatbelt on, will stop you, give you a ticket, and tell you to pay them $85, and you have to pay them this $85. It's done under contract. That's because you've got a driver's license, and you agreed that you would obey all the laws of the state. And so the state simply creates laws in commerce for the purposes of making profit and gain. Because they know that a certain number of people aren't going to practice that law, we can give them a ticket, and we can make money off of it. So we have created a law. We've created a crime. You know, you could go out and get in your car in 1935, drive to the store and come back home, and not break the law. Today, if you go out and get in your car, drive to the store, and don't buckle your seatbelt, that's a crime. And then if we can catch you committing that crime, we can punish you by fining you or taking your driver's license or your car away from you. So the state makes multiple billions and billions and billions of dollars a year, not by taking all that money away from one or two individuals at gunpoint, but by taking just $5 from everybody that wants to drive a car. Now, there's 195 million licensed drivers in the United States, and so $5 times 195 million. Let me plug that into my famous Texas Instruments machine here. Let's take 195 and see if it's big enough. I'll put in all these zeros. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There it is. 195 million times point. No, we'll just times 5. That's $975 million. Yeah, 975. That's about $1 billion. So around the country, we charge all of the drivers in the country $1 billion to go down, sign up, and get this license. This license now is an adhesion contract. Under the terms and conditions of the adhesion contract written into your state statutes. See, just like the warranty card, your driver's license is this little piece of paper that you stick in your wallet with some words on it. And you say, well, that's my driver's license. No, it isn't. No. That is the highest and best evidence of the license, which is contained in your state statutes. So the legislature now has 2,000 statutes, 2,000 do's and don'ts, 2,000 rules for you to follow in the operation of your automobile. God runs the entire universe on 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. And your traffic code in your state has more than 2,000. Three times as many laws in your traffic code as the creator of the universe uses to run the whole damn universe. Well, you can see that when God writes a law, thou shalt not steal. You know, for instance, there's four words and covers the basis of all property rights in four words. Now take a look at your tax code, like Title 26. Hell, there's 15 volumes in the U.S. Code concerning Title 26, just talking about the statutes regulating the income tax, for crying out loud. I think God's got a better program, if you want my druthers, but then I'm not here to criticize one way or the other. But that's not where the money's made. They only get $1 billion for licensing you, but now once they got you licensed, now they can enact laws that apply to all of those licensees. So they come up with a neat one called car registration. You have to register your car. Now we don't have to register our belt buckles yet. But we don't have to register our knives, forks, and spoons yet, or our dishes yet, but we have to register our cars. And in many states, your bicycles and your motorcycles and your ATVs. Well, anything that we can get you to register, we charge you a fee. Now, I was out in California here some years back, and my machine had broken down. I was in this guy's shop, and he's fixing my machine. And we were chit-chatting a little bit, and he said that out here in California, he just bought a brand-new pickup, and paid over $2,000 to register it. And I was aghast. I said, $2,000 to register a pickup? See, I'm from the Midwest here in Missouri. I don't think here in Missouri we charge more than $100 for a new one, maybe. I don't buy new ones, but, you know, it isn't very much here. You know, the last time I think we registered a car was it's $30-$40, something like that. Well, this guy paid $2,000. Now, he said, if you have an old pickup, you know, it's $35. But if you have a brand new pickup, it's $2,000. Oh, that kind of tickled me a little bit. And I was talking about that, and I had a guy from Virginia in here. And he had a very expensive sports car, and he paid $7,000 in the state of Virginia to register his sports car, you know, expensive car, in Virginia. I said, oh, my God, you got to be kidding me. Yeah. So this is the way that we soak the rich. See, you know, if you're going to buy a new pickup out in California, we'll charge you $2,000 to register it. That's where the money's at. And the state rakes in billions of dollars. Now, if the mafia did something like that, you know, you'd just be mad as a hornet. But when the state does, oh, it's okay. Well, that's because we're Baal worshippers here in this country, and we worship the state. The state makes our laws, and we follow those laws. And that's what worship is. You worship your God, and the state of California is the God of you Californians out there. And so you worship your God by paying $2,000 to your God. You know, the creator of the universe, all he requires is 10%. 10%. You could drive your car free under the Mosaic law. They don't register the cars. They don't require driver's licenses. One of these days, Jesus will come back, and then you'll be able to drive your car without any registration fees, without any license plates, and without any driver's license. And somebody's going to say, oh my God, what are we going to do without registration and driver's licenses? What are we going to do without driver's licenses? Well, boys and girls, there was life before driver's licenses. There was life before marriage licenses. There was life before public school. There was life before the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. We had 10 commandments. Honest to God, we used to have a law in this country called the 10 commandments. You know, like thou shalt not steal. We used to teach that to students in public school. Thou shalt not steal. I know it's a wild concept, but we didn't have very much theft. We didn't have very much crime in this country. You know, you shall do no murder. It's against the law to kill people. It's against the law to just drive down the street and shoot people off the street corners. It's a bad practice. Now, in our country today, we don't teach our young people, thou shalt not steal and you shall do no murder, but we teach them to register their cars and buckle their seatbelts. You can rest assured that the kid that's driving down the street and shooting people out of the windows of his car on the street corner is wearing his seatbelt. Well, for his own protection, of course. Now, constructive quasi-contracts were created or are created by statute on the premise that they are needed as a matter of reason and justice and are allowed to be enforced ex contractu. So says Kraft Foods Company versus Wisconsin versus Commodity Credit Corporation. That's a case, you know. These are citations from cases that have been litigated, and then we take these principles of law that are handed down. And these principles of law come out of our courts based upon the statutes that are enacted by our legislatures. Now, if you're coming to the conclusion that these quasi-contracts or these adhesion contracts are immoral, or they're wrong, or they're wicked and evil in some way, you are 100% correct. Boy, they're about as wicked and evil as anything that you could dream up. But, you know, they're part and parcel with our society. They're a part and parcel of our law. They're a part and parcel with our everyday way of life. Well, at least in this country. I can't imagine driving down the road without my seatbelt on. Can you? But I wanted to point out that there was a time when we had a greater measure of freedom and liberty in this country before it was usurped by these adhesion contracts that we've all agreed to participate in for our own health, safety, and welfare, because evidently you and I are unable to make these kinds of decisions of and by and for ourselves. So, we now have the state, our God, employ highway patrolmen to give us tickets and fining us, punishing us, penalizing us, enforcing a penal clause in a contract that we agreed to when we got our driver's license and registered our cars and so on, to buckle our seat belts for our own safety, because evidently you and I can't do that for ourselves. Now, I don't like that, but it comes from limited liability. And that's because you want insurance. See, you don't want to be responsible for the damages that you might cause driving down the road, so you buy insurance. That shifts the liability from you to the insurance company. Well, the insurance company is sitting there saying, well, if we're going to be liable for the damages that this guy causes, we need some safety rules and regulations to limit his activities so that he can't cause any more damages than is absolutely necessary. That's why you have laws that require you to stop at the stop sign, or drive on the right side of the road, or buckle your seatbelt. All these traffic regulations that you see here are aimed at protecting the claims window of the insurance company. And somebody's going to say, Oh, my God. Gordon's advocating the abolition of stop signs. Well, I didn't say that. I said, the reason you have stop signs, you know, there was a time in America before stop signs. And it could well be that stop signs are very reasonable and very logical as a regulation of traffic and commerce, you know, but seat belts aren't. Driver's licenses aren't. Auto registration isn't. Now, there's 2,000 laws that you have here on the books, and these 2,000 laws are all enforced in the name of the health, safety, and welfare of the people. Some of them make sense and some of them don't. But the point is, you have a contract in your driver's license and it doesn't make any difference whether they make sense or don't or whether you want to do it or not. If you don't, there's a penal clause over here, and the purpose for it is to extract from you taxes in the forms of penalties and fines. That's where the money's at. That's the purpose behind it. So, it's a symbiotic relationship between the insurance company, the auto industry, and the state, because the three of them know that you want an automobile. And so, the automobile industry says, well, we don't care about seatbelts one way or the other. So, the insurance company does, and they go to the legislature. The legislature enacts the law, and all of the auto manufacturers have to put seatbelts in, which doesn't affect their bottom line at all because they just add that on to the price of the car. In fact, it adds to it. For instance, if it costs General Motors $100 to put in the seatbelts, they charge $200 to deliver an automobile to you with seatbelts in it. So you have to pay $200 for the seatbelts. General Motors makes $100 profit off of this new addition. See, they used to sell you white sidewall tires, heaters and radios. Now they sell you seatbelts. They just charge for it. And there's no competitive disadvantage because Ford has to put them in there also. And so does Dodge. Everybody has to put them in. So since everybody has to put them in by law, under the terms of our contract now, then you have to buy it whether you want it or not. So it's not a marketplace decision. It's a decision that's made by your state for you. You will buy seatbelts. All right. Now, the next step is, if you don't use the seatbelt, then it damages the insurance company. So the insurance company says, well, we need fines and penalties for those people that won't wear them. And so we enact that. We don't say, because we want to make fines and penalties and protect the claims window of the insurance company, we say, we want to protect little children that you dumb people out there don't buckle up. All right, so now the cop goes out, and his job is to enforce this law. He's just doing his job. But it takes away this right to choose from you. Yeah, that's right. It was a bad choice when you were driving down the street without your seatbelt on. But we used to believe in this country that people should choose for themselves. And even if they make the wrong choices and pay consequences, that's the price of liberty and freedom. We let you decide. Now we have what's known as the nanny state. And the state now decides what's good for you, how you should live your life. It's like living in a mental hospital where somebody's always coming around telling you, you know, what your conduct should be and how you should conduct yourself. And if you don't do that, then we're going to put you in a straitjacket and punish you and take away your bread and milk or something else. So, it should be noted that ex contractu is a term from the civil law in contradistinction to ex delicto from the common law. Ex contractu is a form of action under the civil law, whereas under the common law it would arise from actions of case, replevin, trespass, or trover. Now, these are kind of wild words, replevin, trespass, and trover. But it used to be that if you cause somebody a damage, then we're going to come after you and make you pay for it. Now we got a different program. The program now is we're seeking to prevent a damage. And if you don't cooperate in preventing the damage, then we're going to punish you. So, let's try it this way. You don't stop at the stop sign, and you run through the stop sign, and you hit somebody, and you cause them a damage. Well, under the common law, you have to pay for all of the damages that you cause. And so, you're at fault, and you have to pay for the damages. All right, now we take the next one down here. You're driving down the street, and you run through the stop sign. You didn't stop. but there wasn't anybody out there in your road, and so you didn't cause any damage. Well, if there's no damage, well, then there's nothing for you to pay. So it's a nullity in law. Now let's take it a step further. Let's seek to prevent damages. Thou shalt stop at the stop sign. And if you fail to stop at the stop sign, we will fine you $50. Now you're driving down the street, and you don't stop at the stop sign. You drive on through. There's nobody there. You don't cause any damage. You don't hit anybody or cause any damage. But there's a cop there. And so he sees you drive through the stop sign. He says, well, my God, if somebody had been there, he would have caused a damage. So since he would have caused a damage had somebody been there, therefore, I'm going to rush out here and give him a ticket because the law says thou shalt not run thy stop signs. And so he gives you a ticket and you have to come in, pay $50. Nobody's been injured. Nobody's been damaged. There's no problems out here. But you breached your contract, which said, I agree that I will stop at the stop sign. And you didn't do that. I agree that I will buckle my seatbelt. And you didn't do that. No damages are caused. Nobody is injured thereby. But they could have been, maybe, theoretically, if, but sapped. Now, this is immensely profitable for the state. Nobody's damaged, but you have to pay because you breached your contract. We do this with your mortgage payment. You know, in your mortgage contract, it says, thou shalt pay thy mortgage payment by the 5th of the month. But for whatever reason, you don't pay your mortgage by the 5th of the month, but you do pay the mortgage on the 6th, 7th, or 8th. But you're late. And so there's a clause in the contract, paragraph 18, which says, thou shalt pay thy mortgage by the 5th, and if thou should fail, thou shalt pay a fine, premium, penalty of 5% of the mortgage payment. Now suppose that your mortgage payment is $1,000. And times 0.05 is $50. So you come in on the 6th or the 7th to make your mortgage payment, and the clerk, the teller says, oh, wait a minute, you're late, and we're going to impose a late fee of $50. Okay. Let's suppose that you came in and you paid your mortgage payment 5 days early. Let's suppose that you came in and paid your mortgage payment on the 1st instead of on the 5th. You're 5 days early. Does that same clerk or teller say, oh my God, Mrs. Ballmortal, you are 5 days early. Therefore, we will give you a $50 discount. You only have to pay $950. But if we take it to the other side, you don't have to be 5 days late, you can just be 1 hour late. You could just be 1 day late. And they charge you the full 5% of the late payment, which is $50. Is that fair? Is that equitable? No, but it's in the contract. And the contract is written by the bank and their legal department. And it's an adhesion contract that you didn't even read, don't know anything about. Probably couldn't read it anyway if you've been to public school. But it is imposed upon you, whether you like it or not. How do you like that? Isn't that just real special? Now, you didn't get that from God. You got that from the civil law state. Always remember now, don't blame God for that. He did not dream up interest and usury. All right, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, the schedule and our archives, and that can be accessed through our website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Now again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you do hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about contract. There is a particular type of contract. We call them adhesion contracts. They're everywhere. They represent your driver's license and a number of other things, marriage license and birth certificates and things like that, that have legal ramifications. They have consequences that you may not know about and may not be able to find. You wouldn't know where to look for the contract that regulates the warranty clause, for instance, on the toaster that you just bought down at Walmart. So I told you, well, that's General Electric, and they're headquartered in Connecticut, I believe. Now, many corporations are headquartered in Delaware, so you'd have to go to the Delaware Secretary of State to find those contracts. But closer to home, you've got adhesion contracts right there in your pocket, like your driver's license, for instance, or maybe it's the mortgage on your house. Now, the mortgage on your house is not an adhesion contract, per se. It can have some aspects of adhesion, but the mortgage on your house is a real live contract. It may be a take-it-or-leave-it contract, and that's why I say it may have some aspects of adhesion to it, but it's pretty straightforward. In other words, when you went to the closing, remember you went to this ceremony called a closing? It's kind of like bar mitzvah or communion, you know. You go to this meeting, and there's all these people in the room over here, and papers are flying around in the room, and these papers require your signature. Every time you sign your name, there's a contract, there's an agreement, there's an impairment of your liberty there. Otherwise, you wouldn't need to sign your name. There's a purpose behind that. It's your seal. It's your agreement. It's your word. So you signed this mortgage agreement. And somewhere in there was a clause that made that reference to the late payment. There's nothing in there on the early payment. Now, what I would do if I was at the closing and I looked at paragraph 18 and it said, thou shalt pay a 5% late payment, then I would look across the table at the banker and say, well, excuse me, sir, how much of a discount are you going to give me if I make an early payment? And then if the guy on the other side of the table said, well, if you pay your payment early, you get no discount. But if you pay your payment late, by 5 minutes, thou shalt pay me 5%. I would say, sir, isn't that unfair? Isn't that unreasonable? Let us rewrite paragraph 18. Let's do it this way. I agree that I will pay you in the first 5 days of the month. and for every day that I am late with my payment, I will pay you 1%. But, on the other hand, I agree to pay you within the first 5 days of the month, but for every day that I pay you before the due date, you will reduce the payment for that month by 1%. I mean, you know, fair's fair, ain't it? What's good for the goose ought to be sauce for the gander, shouldn't it, Mr. Banker? Huh? What do you think? Now, bankers are not fair people. They're business people. And they will impose upon you a contract that is unconscionable if they could get away with it. And who could blame them? I mean, I'm not ridiculing or making fun of you bankers out there because you're sticking it to the schmucks that come in and sign the contracts. I mean, if they're so damn dumb that they can't read and they agree to such egregious terms as you impose upon them, I guess that's okay. But you know, I'm a little different than that. I actually read these contracts. I have my famous 10-power loop here. And I got that when I started collecting coins. I have to have a 10-power loop. And I got to using my 10-power loop, you know, that I used to grade coins, and I got to reading contracts, the fine print. God, when you get down to start and read the fine print in those contracts, you're going to get an education, boys and girls, like you ain't never seen before. I mean, it's going to shock you. You're going to be shocked. They're not writing those contracts in fine print because they're trying to save paper and protect the environment and save trees. They're writing that fine print so that you can't read it, so that you won't know what the egregious terms and conditions of this agreement really are. That's why your legislature gives you a driver's license, this little piece of paper you stick in your wallet, and hide the statutes in books in law libraries, and then have codes and systems to keep the terms and conditions of that traffic code away from you. I always ask my students when I come in here, I said, do you know how many statutes, rules, regulations, customs, usages, and practices you have in your state in your traffic code? And they always look at me with a blank stare. They don't shake their heads, no, I have no idea. They don't say, yes, there's 2,414, and I read them all, counted them, and I'm familiar with all of the terms and conditions of my driver's license contract. No, they just look at you with a blank stare, like, why would you even ask? Who knows and who cares? And I said, well, would it surprise you to know that there are more than 2,000? And then they all look at you like, and they nod their head, yeah, I would be real surprised that there's 2,000. Because, you see, you went down and took a test when you got your driver's license, and they had 50 questions. And you thought there were 50 laws. And you got, you know, 75, 80, 85%. And so, well, I know about 75, 80, or 90% of the traffic laws of my state because I took the test. No. They asked you 50 questions out of 2,000. 2,000. That's how many you got. Hell, your highway patrolman that's issuing the tickets, he doesn't know how many traffic statutes there are. In fact, he just has his common... The highway patrolman has a little card that he carries in his car. And it's got about 50 common violations. You know, like he ran the stop sign or he was speeding or something like that. And he's got those traffic citations on it. We'll get down to the nitty-gritty over here. The highway patrolman hasn't got any more idea how many laws there are in your state traffic code than you do. And he's out there enforcing it, for crying out loud. All right, so that's what we call an adhesion contract. You don't know anything about it. And they're unconscionable, and you probably ought not to participate in them, but you do, and you do because of ignorance. I didn't know. I didn't say you were stupid now or dumb. I said you're ignorant. You didn't know. Okay, well, now I'm telling you, so now you know. Now, next time you want to sign one of these contracts over here, why don't you ask some hard questions? You know, you're going in to buy a car. Why don't you ask the salesman over there what the effective interest is in dollars and cents per month at 14% APR versus 10% APR? And probably the poor sap, having gone to public school, probably could not calculate it for you. Probably. But there is a card that he got from the bank that will do it automatically. Why don't you ask the real estate broker next time what the difference between 6% and 6.64% interest is in the dollars per month that you have to pay on this mortgage? You can calculate that and you can figure it. In fact, if you want to get into some real deep higher math, we call it the rule of 72. Rule of 72. What you do is you take the interest rate and divide that into 72, and that'll tell you how long it takes to double. For instance, let's suppose that you're going to buy a house, and the salesman says, "Oh, I've got a wonderful interest rate. It's only 6.64%. Isn't that marvelous?" That's the real estate salesman telling you that this interest rate of 6% is just marvelous. And what that means is, when we translate it out, you're going to borrow $50,000 from the bank on this mortgage and pay it out over 360 payments. That's 30 years. And what you want to know is, how many houses am I buying for myself and how many houses am I buying for the banker? And what that means in plain language is, at 6.64, let's take 72 and divide that by 6.64, and the answer is 10.84. So that means that every 10.84 years, you're buying one house for the banker. At the end of 30 years, you'll have one house for you. And at the end of 30 years, the banker will have 10.84 years, but he'll have one house at the end of 10 years, two houses at the end of 20 years, and three houses at the end of 30 years. Isn't that special? Okay, here's what that means. You're going to buy two houses for the banker and one house for yourself at 6.64% interest. Is that what you had in mind when you signed up? In addition to that, there's going to be penalties and all kinds of other costs that are attributable to this program also, such as property taxes in paragraph 9, which says that you're responsible for all of the property taxes and that you have to insure this property to protect the banker and his loan, and you have to have a life insurance policy. So you'll have to have homeowner's insurance, fire insurance, and life insurance, and all of that has to be paid for by you. Got that? And you agree to those terms and conditions in the contract. And that's why I'm telling you it's not an adhesion contract per se, because those terms and conditions are actually spelled out in the document, and all you have to do is read it. Now, if you're 20 years old and have 20/20 vision, you will not be able to read the terms and conditions in the contract because it's written in fine print, and you will need a 10-power loop, but you can get it at any coin store for about $30. I recommend them highly. I think everybody should have a 10-power loop to read the terms and conditions of their contracts. Now remember, these are called ex contractu, is a term from the civil law in contradistinction to ex delicto from the common law. And that's because we no longer practice the common law here in the United States. Now, ex contractu actions are from the civil law, not from the common law, and they're enforced by actions in personam. Constructive quasi-contracts are based solely upon a legal fiction or fiction of law. And since there's no agreement and a remedy is desired, they're treated as a contract. And since there is no agreement, as in contracts, the obligation arises from natural equity. Natural equity. Equity. And we'll split the baby in two. Constructive quasi-contracts include obligations founded upon statutory duties, like buckling your seatbelt. A debt arising or resulting from a normal agreement or contract has always been the result of a promise to pay and invoked a remedy in the form of a sumpset, penalty clause in the contract. However, an sumpset, the penalty clause in the contract, cannot be applied to actions of debts where there is no agreement unless the court does so by means of a fiction, because in order to support a sumpset, it is necessary to allege a promise, and without agreement, there is no promise. Okay, so now in a contract, remember, you got four elements here. We have to have an agreement. The agreement is an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. That's what makes a contract. So you take a look at the seat belt. Do you have a contract with your seat belt? Well, of course you do. Watch this. You went down and you got a driver's license. The state offered you the license. You accepted over time and you paid them $5. There's the consideration. There's the contract. Then you go to the dictionary and it says, but a license is not a contract. So you go out and you drive your car without buckling your seatbelt. Along comes Ranger Rick and he says, oh my God, you're driving without a seatbelt. Here's a ticket. Take it down to the judge. The judge looks at it and he says, the fine is $85. And you say, well, hell, I never agreed to buckle my seatbelt. That wasn't on the test when I took my driver's license examination. And the judge then turns to one of the 2,000 statutes in your traffic code and says, oh, here it is right here. It's Missouri Code 302.177. And it says right here, thou shalt buckle thy seatbelt or a range of fines of $300 and 3 months in jail can be imposed. He says, you know, I could put you in jail for 90 days and fine you $300 if I wanted to. You agreed to that when you got your driver's license. And you're sitting there saying, huh? I never agreed to anything like that. Well, yes, you did. Sure you did. You agreed to obey all the laws and rules and regulations. Now, the judge imposes one more little thingy on you. He says, but tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to fine you $85, and I'm going to suspend any jail time, and I'm going to put you on probation for 1 month, 6 months, or a year. Now get this. On the terms of the probation, he says, do you agree that you will obey all of the laws of Missouri during the period of this probation? Now remember, this probation now is a discount. The fine prescribed by the legislature is $300 fine and 90 days in jail. That's what we propose to do to you because you didn't buckle your seatbelt. But we're having a sale today. We're having a special. And we'll only fine you $85, and we will suspend the jail time so that you don't lose any time off work, which is more expensive than the fine. But you have to agree, you have to contract with us that you will obey all the laws of Missouri during the period of your probation. Boys and girls, you don't even know what all of the laws of Missouri are. Now, how in the hell can you promise to the judge, yes, sir, Your Honor, everybody does this. I mean, just walk into the court and listen. Everybody does this. Oh, yes, yes, because you're going to offer me probation. I promise I will obey all the laws of Missouri for a whole year. And so he says, well done, little child. Pat you on your little pointed head and send you out with the $85 ticket, and you pay the clerk the $85, and now you have agreed to obey all the laws. I was in court one time, and Charlie Brown, our local judge, he said, now, Gordon, you've been driving without a driver's license here, and I'm going to give you this fine, and I'm going to punish you, and I'm going to suspend the jail time and do all these wonderful things because we're having a special here in the Ozark County Courthouse today. He said, now, as the terms of the probation, you agree that you'll get a driver's license, and you agree that you'll obey all the laws of Missouri for a whole year. Do you agree to that? And I said, no, sir. I think that was the first time in that judge's career that he ever proposed such a wonderful deal and had somebody said, no, sir. No, I don't want to buy that. If I went into a closing and the banker proposed to me that I pay him 5% of a late fee, I would counteroffer and say, good, I'll pay you 5% of the payment as a late fee if you'll pay me 5% if it's an early fee. I pay you 5 days early, you give me a $50 discount. If I pay you 5 days late, you take a $50 penalty. You know, I always figured fair is fair. Now, the reason that I told Judge Brown no, that I would not agree to obey all the laws of Missouri for a whole year. Some of the laws of Missouri violate the law of God. Did you know that? It's true. The state legislature has enacted laws that if you were to follow those laws, you would be in violation of the law of God. Example, in our state, we have licensed our meat packers to put 30% fat into the hamburger. If I agreed to obey the fat law of Missouri, I would agree to eat 30% fat at thy McDonald's restaurant. I can't eat McDonald's fat at McDonald's restaurant. It would violate Leviticus 3, verse 17. So I have to respectfully decline to obey all the laws of Missouri because some of the laws violate the law of God. You know, some of these laws, for instance, do you agree to pay this $85 fine? No, sir, I don't. Well, why not? Well, because you want me to pay $85 in unjust weights and balances called Federal Reserve notes, which is a violation of Leviticus 19, 35, and 36. It says you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. And I don't use Federal Reserve notes. I told Judge Hamilton that one time, and she was shocked. She says, well, what do you propose to pay in? I says, well, I could pay it in wheat, corn, beans, honey, oil, gold, silver. And she said, well, we can't take any of those things. I had a student one time paid a debt down in Salt Lake City with wheat. The judge down there, I think he was a little sharper. And the kid, he said, well, I can pay the fine in wheat. And so he calculated it out, and he said, well, that's 900 and some odd pounds of wheat. And so she delivered 900 and some odd pounds of wheat to the courthouse, and they took pictures and put it in the Salt Lake Tribune, and had quite a little scene down there. She paid her fine in just weights and balances. I'm not quite sure how the traffic court handled 900 pounds of wheat, but I'm sure that, no, the Mormons, you know, they're a little smarter people than the average, and so I'll just bet you that Mormon judge figured out what to do with 900 pounds of wheat. Those Mormons, they know what to do with wheat. Rest of us, we wouldn't have a clue. And then I'm telling you right now, Charlie Brown wouldn't. Now, can you see where we're going with this? Adhesion contracts. You agreed to it. You just didn't know when, you didn't know how, and you didn't know where. But now I told you. Now you're smarter today than you were yesterday. These constructive quasi-contracts include obligations founded upon statutory duties. The statutory duties are laid out in your statutes. You might not know that. You might not know where those statutes are located. You probably couldn't find them at high noon. In broad daylight, with a road map. But they're there, and you agree to them, and that's what's being imposed upon you. And it comes from limited liability. If you want to know where your freedoms and liberties have gone, they have gone to the insurance industry called limited liability. All right, we're out of time. I got to give you a reminder that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by pre-arrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time is up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.